Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Regular readers of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch are familiar with the byline Aisha Sultan. Her regular column on parenting and family life, Dirty Laundry, has been a popular feature in the paper since 2008. She has expanded that to an online presence, encouraging conversations on our sometimes upside-down, hectic family lives, and that has led her to the next level, national syndication. Universal UClick has picked her up for that next step, and in a few months, she'll be joining people like Dear Abby and Ann Coulter, not to mention Doonesbury, Ziggy, and Garfield. Aisha Sultan, home and family editor and columnist at the Post-Dispatch, joins me in studio. We welcome you, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
What a nice next step this is for you after all that hard work, 15 years at the paper, 5 years with the column. Nice step.
Thank you. Thank you. It is nice to be noticed and hopefully expand the number of people and the people who have access and can read the column.
How did it all come about?
So I got an email from the acquisitions editor at Universal UClick, which used to be called Universal Press Syndicate, which is the largest syndicate in the world. And they said, we've been following your work and it's been brought to our attention, but we haven't launched a column in 5 years. We haven't launched a new feature because the media market has been so bad. And you and I were just talking about how brutal it's been in our industry. And a lot of newspapers don't want to pay for content. But they've got a ton of space online to fill. They still have sections to fill. And so they said, you know, we're interested in trying something with your column because we think there's potential here. And I think one thing that perhaps interested them was the fact that, like you mentioned, you know, we are doing a lot more stuff in online and with social media and with video and radio and online chats. And so let's see how it goes. The launch is, I think, around Labor Day.
Right. And will you be doing a single column or a regular daily column, or how is that going to work?
Well, right now, you know, it will be the column that runs in the Post-Dispatch. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see. You know, we'll sort of see how it picks up and takes off. And if it does, you know, be nice to be able to write more frequently.
There is no lack of subject matter out there
for
you.
That's the thing. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. There's plenty to write about. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of ironic, don't you think, that in this time, as you mentioned, we've been talking about what's going on with the media, that with the newspapers doing as badly as they seem to be doing, that all of a sudden the online world is what's giving you this great opportunity.
Well, that's absolutely true. And you're right. There have been tremendous changes in our industry and in newspapers specifically, and not all of them have been good. We've lost a lot of talented people. We've lost a lot of resources that we used to have. But on the other side, there have been really amazing bright spots in terms of how many people can read you and find you, and this new avenue for interacting with the people who do read you. I don't know. In some ways, it's like scary, but in another way, it's also really exciting.
Right? How did you get into this particular area, the area of parenting and family life?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I was a news reporter for 10 years, mm-hmm. and I sort of fell into news reporting to begin with. But once I was there, I didn't expect to ever do anything different because I really enjoyed it. I covered education for many years, and then I was a general assignment reporter, and I worked on a lot of stories that meant a lot to me. But then I had children. You know, and my children are here in the studio with me today. And when I had kids, I felt like it changed my perspective on the way that I read the paper. And I've been a lifelong newspaper reader and consumer of news. So before, when I read the newspaper, I felt like, especially my local paper, it gave me a chance to feel connected to a community. Like, you know, what was going on in City Hall or with the mayor, or anything that was happening. It made me feel part of something. But then when I had children, I felt like the things that were most important in my day and the choices that I was struggling to make and those decisions that seemed so pressing and difficult and isolating, I didn't see that reflected in our news pages necessarily because it was outside the sphere of public life. It was private life, you know? And up until that point, my private life had been mostly just about me. And now it was about these other human beings that I was responsible for raising in some, you know, fashion. And so at that point, I approached the paper and I said, and this was, you know, 2 years before the column even launched. And Christy Bertelsen, who was a features editor and had been at the paper for a very long time, had just recently taken over as features editor. I went to them and I said, I feel like we're not talking to a large percentage of our potential readers, or we're not connecting with them. And I feel like these are the types of stories I would like to be able to tell. And I have an opinion on a lot of what I read and what's going on, and I would like to be able to write a column. And so I made this pitch over and over, like had this little PowerPoint that I would show to editors, whoever I could sort of grab, you know. And so Christy Bertelsen said, I think there's merit in this idea. And we had been running some online stuff that was more anecdotal, more personal narrative. And I said, well, I'd really like to bring my news background into this and write about what might be happening in our lives as parents, but informed from reporting national trends, studies, you know, what other people are talking about, that gives you a little more to bite onto than just, you know, this is what happened in my day.
A world that I'm assuming was more or less invisible to you until you had a family of your own.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
You know, it seems to me that one thing we are not taught as we get older is how to be a parent.
That's
true. The only experience we have is the way we were brought up, for better or for worse. But there's really no place to go to learn how to do it right. And I guess that's you kind of fill that role in many ways.
Oh, goodness. I don't know that I fill that role. But I think initially when I wanted to write it, I felt like I was stumbling and I was doing I was making so many mistakes and I didn't know if I was doing anything right or wrong. And I guess a lot of parents feel that way. We're just doing our best, you know. And so I thought, I read a ton about parenting as it is, read a lot of people who are writing about it and doing smart studies about it. So why don't I try to make sense of this for myself, and maybe someone else will find it useful.
What was the first column you ever wrote? Do you recall?
Yeah, I do. I remember it very well because, I also remember Christy Bertelsen made me like rewrite the ending to it three times. But
that's what editors do.
That's
right?
What they do, right? Yeah. So I wrote about how when my daughter was born, for 6 months, I did not really take a break from her for any extended period of time. Like, she was just, and I was nursing, you know, so she was just always with me, always on me, always in my presence. And I think once I left her for an hour to go vote. And at some point I had like a, you know, minor breakdown when my husband said he had to work a weekend, and they were launching a hospital project, so he was working quite a bit. And I just ran out of the house, like barefoot, or, you know, early in the morning. There was snow on the ground, and I didn't even have my glasses on, which I really need to see. And the fact that he was just not going to be around that weekend, and I was so overwhelmed with taking care of this baby constantly, I was like, that's it. I'm out. I'll see ya. I'm leaving. So I like ran to my car, and, you know, I'm sure the neighbors must have been like, what is wrong with this woman? Like, I'm in my, you know, nightgown. And I started the car, and then I realized, like, I don't have my glasses. Now what do I do? I can't really see. So I sort of drove around the block, and then I came back, and I sort of like that walk of shame back into the house. Right. Like, I'm not really going anywhere. But it was that moment of crisis. And I wrote about how that feeling of feeling so overwhelmed and isolated and not knowing how you're going to make it through the next day is very common and relatable. And perhaps I should have looked at how much of myself I was putting into parenting and how much I needed to like create a space for my own mental health.
What was the response to that?
Well, it was tremendous. You know, I mean, I got hundreds of emails and letters and comments, and people were like, oh my God, thank God, you know, someone's writing about these things. And this was before mommy bloggers and parenting bloggers were as prevalent and, you know, as they are now. But at the time, I don't think that people were talking about the difficulties and the challenges and just how, you know, crazy it could be. As openly, because it does make you feel a little vulnerable to admit, I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm doing it right. I don't know if I'm making mistakes that are doing irreparable harm.
You don't give advice per se. Maybe
no.
Maybe suggestions, what have you. But you don't consider yourself an advice giver.
No, I don't, because I feel like people are going to make, you know, people have to make decisions based on their own circumstances. But I guess I see my role more as someone who is observing what's happening, not just within our families, but in our society as it relates to families and what's happening with the way our kids are growing up, and then being able to say something about that and have an opinion about that. I think that's why the columns that get the most response are the ones that I take a pretty strong position on.
You're letting people know that they are not alone.
You let people know that you're not alone, and you also let people know that, you know, even though right now our culture is so child-centric, I come from it from the perspective that, you know, parents are the ones who make the decisions for their children up until a certain age, and we're the ones guiding their development. And so, yes, like, let your kids, you know, have unstructured playtime and free time and all of this, but realize you're the one in charge. And I think there's a moment in which we forget that. You know,
it's I guess I can say it's for you and for all of us as parents. It's a learning process throughout, because the crisis that you had at 6 months, the kids get older and different crises emerge.
Yeah. And you think, oh, you know, it's going to get easier. It's going to get easier. But a colleague of mine at the paper told me, you know, little people, little problems, big people, big problems. Mm-hmm. And when he was telling me about raising kids and he had older children, it's true. Their needs and the decisions and the challenges you face just evolve as they get older.
And they will continue to do so.
They do.
You know, a mother is a mother, and the child can be 50, and if the mother is still around, it's still going to be looking at it as a mother.
Well, absolutely. I feel that way with my own mom. Thank God she's there for me to turn to for advice. But, you know, and that said, I mean, certainly I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, parenting is one big chore and this difficult sort of whatever experience. It is challenging, but it is, for me, it felt like the most incredibly transformative experience in my life. And the way I described it in that first column was, I was in fifth grade when I first got a pair of glasses. And up until that point, I had not realized that you could actually see the edges on leaves. You could see this sharpness and detail of what you could see. I remember that moment so vividly. And I remember when my children were born, it felt like my emotions took on that sharpness and that vividness. Like, I had felt anger and I had felt love and I had felt frustration, but I'd never felt it in such intensity and clarity until my kids were born.
Well, I'm watching your children now. You can't see them. They're behind you through the glass. And I have to say this, they seem most interested in what mommy is saying on the radio. Let's take a break. Aisha Sultan is my guest. She is the columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the family and parenting columnist, if you will. Mm-hmm. The column is Dirty Laundry. She goes into national syndication around Labor Day, she tells us. We'll come back and talk about that. And naturally, we'd like to get you into the conversation. If you'd like to converse with Aisha, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk at stlpublicradio.org. And you can also send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back in just a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Aisha Sultan, columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You're familiar with the column, Dirty Laundry. It goes into national syndication. She's very busy online and having conversations with people who deal with the same kinds of issues that she's had to deal with as a parent and as a family. Aisha, do you anticipate that when you go national that the problems are going to be the same, that you'll be hearing from people from Texas and Washington State and from Maine with the same kinds of things that you are dealing with here?
Yeah, I imagine that to a certain extent, some of these challenges are universal and some of the concerns, you know, are not specific to St. Louis by any means. But I think each area has its sort of own way of bringing these issues to light. Like, I'll give you an example. This is a column that I want to write. I'm not sure if it'll be in the next few weeks or if I'll save it for a little bit longer, but I've been following with great interest the amount of spending and effort and energy that goes into prom, senior proms. Wow. And there was a story last month that showed how spending is now at, like, you know, over $1,000 for families for this one night, this one high school night. And not just that, but the way you ask a date, the prom proposal, it has become like just as big as a wedding proposal. And I've been hearing this chatter locally for a while, and I've been following nationally what people have been saying about it. And one interesting thing that came out in the study that Visa did, like Visa did a study of parents on how much they spend per average. And so it was like the Northeast that had the highest spending, close to $2,000 on prom, and then followed by the South, and then the West, and then the Midwest. And I think our average spending in the Midwest was like $700 or $800. And so that right there tells you that, you know, there are differences per region, and there are certain things, certain ways in which being in the Midwest and being in the heartland of this country, I feel like gives me perhaps a more grounded perspective on parenting.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. You know, as you're speaking about this, what I'm thinking is that puts so much pressure on kids and families who can't afford $800.
You know what's so interesting, Don, is the study showed that the parents that end up spending the most are the ones who are in the lowest income bracket.
What does that tell us?
What does that tell you? That it tells you that parents like are really wanting to give their kids this idealized evening, you know, and keeping up with their friends and, you know, at the expense of what? Going into debt for prom?
Well, you know, that brings me to weddings.
Because prom is the new wedding, you know, and that's what I think USA Today or somebody wrote about when they covered the story, is that prom is the new wedding. And I thought, goodness gracious.
You know, we have some friends who now call weddings invoicing.
Right.
Because now you're required to give an engagement gift. There's always going to be a shower. There has to be a wedding gift. And by the time you, the lucky attendee to this blessed event, are through with it, you've probably spent a couple $100.
Well, and you know, you give the gift you give, but the way in which it's sort of blatantly become a money grab in some situations, I mean, I've seen invitations in which you are directed about where to deposit your funds, you know? And so,
absolutely. It's a business almost in itself. The way it's structured, it's very much formalized. I want to bring in something in the context of today's news, and I know you're familiar with this because it's your beat more or less, and that's the Pew study that came out a couple of days ago.
I just read that.
For those who aren't familiar with it, I'll just read the gist of the story right here. It says a record 40% of all households with children under the age of 18 include mothers who are either the sole or primary source of income for the family, according to the Pew Research Center, and this comes from census data. These breadwinner moms are made up of two very different groups. 37% are married mothers who have higher income than their husbands, and 63% who are single mothers. Mm-hmm. This world has changed since 25 or 30 years ago.
Yes. And, you know, it hasn't changed in isolation because this is not necessarily only a cultural phenomenon. It's an economic change that's happened in our country in terms of what's happened to middle-class families. So, yes, on one hand, there's a story to be celebrated in the fact that more women are achieving and being compensated for that more and are able to make these choices about career and family outside of typical gender roles. Yay, you know, that's wonderful. But on the other hand, let's look at what's happened to middle-class families and income for those people, what's happened in the past 20 years. Like those incomes have stagnated or gone down. And the number of single parent households has gone up. So you end up with this is no surprise to anyone, but a study like this brings into focus the impact that it has on our families, like individual families. I know a ton of, this is 40%. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is actually a breadwinner mom yesterday. And I was saying, I anticipate that number will only go up because of what we're seeing happening in the economy in terms of job growth, wages, you know, and marriage trends. You see people getting married later, not getting married, not at all. You see, you know, more and more single parent households. So I think, yes, society has changed. A family doesn't look like the way we imagine in our minds a family looked 20 years ago.
And this puts pressure on marriages and pressure on families. I mean, it's not always received well if the father finds himself in this secondary position, if you will, a position that women have been in for generations.
It can be difficult. I mean, but on the other hand, I think that it can also create a more egalitarian situation within a family. Because, you know, with income comes power, and marriages have a lot to do with power. you know, decision making and who is able to make choices about spending and who decides the way resources are divided and who carries the weight in terms of child rearing and chores at home. I mean, that's a full-time job in itself. How do those chores get allocated? So perhaps with changing economic power, at some point you also see changes in the public, in the private sector of our lives.
Is it a slow process?
I think so, but I think it's happening faster than perhaps our attitudes or cultural attitudes are ready for, because part of that Pew study was the reaction to it that people are not necessarily comfortable with this idea of so many breadwinner moms. It challenges deeply held patriarchal notions in our society about who should be providing and who. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a mother? What does it mean to be a father? Like, all these questions are now in flux. Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's been proven recently that we as a society can change very quickly.
Absolutely.
Much more quickly than perhaps was the case a few years ago. I'm thinking specifically of gay marriage.
I think about that, too.
Yeah. And, you know, a few years ago, it was virtually unthinkable.
Right.
And now it's acceptance is very, very broad and growing steadily.
Right. And the interesting thing that's happened with working moms, because we've seen that number really skyrocket and increase, and the participation of mothers in the workforce has increased over time. But cultural attitudes towards moms in the workplace, I think those will be greatly impacted when we see corporations and companies and our country making more family-friendly policies and choices for people to be able to balance that. Because really what's happened is we've created a second shift of workers where you go and you do your primary job and then you come home and you take care of your children. And where does that support come in at a societal level?
It's interesting you say that, because there's an increasing number of female chief executive officers in the country. However, at Yahoo, and I've forgotten the name of the executive.
Marissa Meyer.
Marissa Meyer, right. Yeah. She had a baby, had a room built, a nursery built right next to her office, and then turned her back on female employees who wanted to work from home.
That was a very interesting decision. I had some thoughts on that. I felt like, it certainly did not really send the best message from a perspective of a working parent. Who is trying to, when you work in an industry where clearly you have the tools and the technology to be able to do your work in a more flexible way, to then turn around and take advantage of that yourself and not necessarily,
It was a funny message. And her employees reacted accordingly. And I think morale at Yahoo is probably not the highest right now. Let's take a call from Pat, who's joining us from Hillsboro, Missouri. Again, our lines are open, 382-8255, if you want to talk to Alicia. Go ahead. Pat, go ahead.
Hello, Alicia. Aisha, I'm sorry.
Yes, no
Aisha.
Problem.
I just will not miss reading your column every Sunday. I so look forward to it, because you have gained so much wisdom in your short number of years on this earth. I'm 66. It took me a whole lot longer to learn what you know.
Bless your heart. Thank you so much. That is very sweet.
Nice of you to call. Now, while we're talking about women in the workplace and the fact that they're playing this increasing role that we've been discussing, they are doing it, but they are doing it still at a much lower wage level than their male counterparts.
Well, and so these are, I think, I just wrote a story recently for the Post-Dispatch, a news story about what local corporations are doing to help executive women, achieve in the workforce, or to raise sort of the bar of where women, what they can accomplish at work. And it was based on this conversation that Sheryl Sandberg started, Lean In, with her book, and why are there so few female executives at the top? What can we do to encourage this? And so I talked to, Ralston Purina and Build-A-Bear and KPMG. And what I found is the places in which parents and mothers are given the flexibility to get their work done outside of traditional work hours. And, the Post-Dispatch has afforded me that ever since I've started writing the column and working for them, that same sort of benefit, are the places in which women are able to achieve in both areas. And the places that have family-friendly policies in terms of leave that you can take after your child is born and your job being there for you, when you come back. And these are the things that I think on a structural level, we have to look at. I mean, why is it that our country does not have the sort of support for mothers returning to work or the leave for women who've just had a baby. Why? Do we not value that? Is that not a part of our what we value? These are the things that seemed so difficult for me to, you know, understand.
Well, you look overseas and you look at places like Scandinavia comes to mind, where this is a given. I mean, the society is totally structured differently in this regard.
Well, you don't even really have to look that far. You can look at Canada, and the maternity leave and the family leave policies are so different. And over here, we struggle to even get sick pay. Like we have so many employees that work, you know, without the protection of a single sick day in this country, let alone paid or protected maternity leave.
What do you hear from stay-at-home dads?
That's a great question. I wrote a story, a feature on stay-at-home dads for Father's Day a couple of years ago. And, you know, I have found that there are two types, at least two types of stay-at-home dads. They're the ones who have completely embraced this role and are super involved with their kids, you know, sports or their extracurriculars, and they're just part of that whole network of what it means to be a stay-at-home parent. And then there are stay-at-home dads who are sort of in between jobs or have been left behind in the way the economy has changed, and they are much more focused on trying to get a foot back in the door, and they're not necessarily embracing that role. And so I think... I think with stay-at-home dads, the ones who are really engaged and see this as what they were meant to be doing right now, like this is actually their purpose and not necessarily something just to pass the time until something better comes along, they look for a place to a community of people that are like them, because a lot of those people are women right now. It's a lot of, you know, so.
Is there a recurring theme for you? I mean, do you find something that just keeps coming back at you?
Well, in terms of like specific things that parents always, always ask about, people always ask about sleep-related questions related to their children. You know, how do I get my child to sleep? My child doesn't sleep. Or how do I sleep train my child? So sleep is a big thing. Food and eating and making sure your child is eating a healthy diet. And that is a really recurrent concern. How do you make sure that your kid is eating healthy, especially when you don't have time to cook meals like we would like to? And then technology, which is what I went to University of Michigan on this fellowship, this Night Wallace Fellowship to study, is what do I do? How do I manage all the technological innovation that my children have access to now, from phones to, you know, iPads and iTouches and all the social networks that they seems to be part of their way of growing up now? How do I make sure that they don't mess up their lives or that they can still read books and still have attention spans and they can still carry on conversations without having to text you to ask you a question? That comes up a lot.
You know, it's funny. It just reminded me, and I want to talk more about this because it's an important part of your life, professional and personal life, I'm sure. But an acquaintance of mine told me recently about going to some place like Steak and Shake. And six teenagers came in. They came in together, and they sat down at a table together. Each one of them pulled out a cell phone and started to text other friends. So here they were together, not having a conversation with each other, but texting other people who are not present.
Well, and we see that all the time, don't we? Even in our families, even at dinners with our families, you know, at games. I mean, we see that everywhere.
We who are a little bit older have to get used to this. And as you say, you spent 11 months studying this.
Right. I wanted to look at how technology was changing families and how what it was like raising kids in a digital age. Like what, and because I was worried about sort of the impact that it has on a child's brain as they develop. And we have pretty strict rules in our house, especially during the school year, about technology use and media consumption. Because there are changes that happen with constant engagement in the way that our brains are wired, in the way that we respond to constant validation on Instagram or you know, living your life in a very public way at a very young age. That's something we have to think about.
Well, you started the column in 2008, 5 years ago.
Yes.
And this sort of thing was going on, but it's vaulted ahead by leaps and bounds.
Absolutely.
Since then.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in the past 5 years, you know, I mean, think about it. Like, you know, Twitter didn't exist. YouTube was totally different. I mean, and Facebook has exploded since then. All these things. I mean, it wasn't when I started writing the column, I could never have imagined that, you know, parents would be buying 8-year-olds and a $200 smartphone. I mean, and that is happens fairly regularly, you know? So yeah, the world in that regard changed very quickly before we were able to have conversations and talk and really think through what we were giving our kids access to and to what extent.
While you're trying to sort this out for yourself through this fellowship, what were you telling people who were calling and scratching their heads about it?
Well, you know, this is what I said. I said, based on just what I've read and what I've seen, I limit my children's access to technology and to screens, especially during the school year, Monday through Friday, we just keep no screens in our house on at all. And then on the weekends, they can, you know, use their email and watch TV. But for now, at least, and my children are 8 and 10, and their needs will change as they get older. But, you know, no computers, no phones, no iPads, no televisions, nothing. Because when you're not in school, like, I want to see your face and I want you to be able to talk to you and have conversations with you and see you guys talk to each other and get bored. Like, you need to know what it feels like to be bored. So anyway, right now that we started that when they were in preschool, and now my daughter's going to fifth grade and she reads all the time.
How otherwise do they react to your rules?
Well, they don't like them, you know. they feel like they're being raised in sort of this abusive household in some ways because I'm really strict about this. And, you know, we do relax the rules in the summer, but it's still not just a free-for-all. But, you get to a point where you can hopefully explain to your child why you're making the choices that you are or why you're – what you hope to accomplish, what you want for them. And, and then at some point you have to just sort of – realize that we pay the bills and we own the house and we make the rules.
That's right. And the father of the children, is he totally on board with all of this?
Yeah, he is. And
he better be, right?
Well, he understands why it's important to not just be attached to a screen for 12 hours out of the day. And I think most adults who did not grow up that way, we don't necessarily want our children to grow up that way.
Sure. Lord knows where it's going to be 5 years from now.
Exactly.
Right. We may be having it in our eyeglasses or a chip under our skin. Right. Have to take another break. We'll do that. Aisha Sultan is our guest. She's a columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, going into national syndication around Labor Day. She does the family and parenting column, Dirty Laundry, which you read every week. We'll come back and continue our conversation, bring you into it. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Aisha Sultan, columnist of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. We're talking about parenting and family and how all of that has changed over the years and how it's an ongoing process of change.
Right.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned a moment ago that I just want to address, talking to your kids about rules and about what you want them to do. You're having a conversation with your children, and it occurs to me from what I've observed that a lot of parents don't have conversations with their children anymore. I mean, very limited anyway, partially because of the digital age, but partially because they're off doing their own thing.
Well, I think the demands on parents are much greater and, you know, than they used to be. I mean, we work longer hours. We're constantly connected to our works, and children are much more scheduled than they used to be. So when you're not at work, you're kind of trying to schedule and plan their day or drive them from place to place. So, I mean, I certainly have a great deal of sympathy with parents not being able to give as much of themselves as they would like to be able to. I certainly feel that way all the time. But that said, John, I would challenge you on this. I think that in the cars during the commutes and at bedtime or during the or in the morning but before your kids go off to school, there are conversations happening in families. Now the question is how can we use that limited amount of time that we make, you know, that we grab, those snatches of conversations, and turn it into something that hopefully, you know, teaches our kids something or plants a seed in their head?
You know, I did an interview recently with Michael Pollan, the food guy. You're familiar with him. He's a very, very interesting guy. And he has a new book out called Cooked. And he was talking about how cooking has brought his family together in the sense that his teenage son comes down and will watch him make something. And that's where they have their conversation. Right. And he said, what's good about it is I'm concentrating on the food. Right. We're not looking at each other in the eye, but we're having – We're not having that conversation. We're having a conversation.
Right.
What a great way to do it.
Right. And the car is the same way for me because, my children are at the age where I'm driving them from activity to activity. And so I just feel like that is a time like we're not looking at each other in the eye. We're sitting at the same level. And it's not that conversation. It is a conversation.
That's interesting you say that because we had another author on. His name is David Sheff. He wrote a book about drug abuse. Very good book. And he said the same thing. And talking to his son who had abuse problems, that he could have these conversations without looking in the – exactly what you just said. What is it about looking kids in the eye?
You know, I wonder if part of it is just that intimidation of like, am I in trouble?
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times when my children were younger, toddlers, and I really wanted to get their attention and they were acting out or not doing what I wanted them to, I would get down on the floor and get exactly at eye level and lower my voice so that they knew I was being serious and I need your full attention.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's a little intimidating when someone is demanding your full attention.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
Right.
Here it comes. We have a couple of emails here relating to things we talked about earlier, Aisha. Natalie writes, thank you for addressing the subject of prom. Please, parents, get together early in the high school years and generate an affordable alternative to prom as we know it. Parents have the power to stop this in uppercase letters. But
yes.
She's shouting at us here.
Yes, yes.
You agree with that?
I completely agree with that because I think I was telling my editor this when I was looking at some of these studies. I'm like, I cannot remember my husband and I ever spending $1,100 on a night. I mean, you know, not including our wedding and the expenses related to that, but just on an evening out together. When do married people ever do this? Never, you know. It seems outrageous.
None that I know. Yeah. Still with the proms. Jean writes, we are coming up on the prom season. How has prom become this monster that no one can resist? Please propose another activity.
I know.
So there is some sentiment out there for change in that regard.
Right. But this is the problem, is that it becomes very difficult for parents with children in that age group to have their kid be the only one who's not doing what all their friends are doing. And then it becomes this sort of like guilt / indulgence. So it does take a coordinated effort on behalf of a large segment of your school population. Like if enough parents in one school say, we're going to do it differently. All of our kids are going to do it differently. We're not going to rent the Hummer limo for $200 each of us, you know, pitching in. We're just not going to do that.
Yeah. There is that other aspect of the prom season, too, and that is there are always a number of teen fatalities.
Absolutely.
Too much drinking going on and driving, drinking. It's bad combination.
A lot of risky behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a call from Kristen, who's joining us from Imperial, Missouri. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my
sure.
call. I also limit my children's media. My 8-year-old is allowed to watch one TV show, a half-hour show a day during the school year, and then 1 hour on the weekends and during the summer. The problem I run into is that all of her friends at school, and she's in second grade, like to watch the kind of what I consider to be teen shows on Nickelodeon, the Hannah Montanas and stuff like that, which I don't find that content appropriate for a child that young. And her argument is, well, if I only get one show, I should get to pick. Do you have any suggestions or advice on how to deal with that?
Well, that's an excellent question because I have found myself in the same situation where I feel like those shows are so inappropriate. And I resisted letting my children watch those for a very long time because I felt like their tone and the words that they use and the way they spoke to one another and to me changed after seeing and, you know, modeling that behavior of these sassy little tweens on those shows. Oh my God, it just got underneath my skin. And so, but that said, because she has made a legitimate point and argument to you, I don't think it's fair to necessarily dismiss that out of hand. I think at that point, it's fair to say to start a conversation and say, let's compromise on this. I hear what you're saying. So maybe once a week, you can choose a show that you want to watch, and then maybe that week or for a few weeks you watch it with her, and then you have a chance to point out, like, oh my God, can you believe how she reacted in that situation? Or would you ever think that that was okay to say to a friend or to a parent? And then, you know, as she gets older, of course, you know, you sort of allow more flexibility. But I think what I try not to do is just if a child makes a concern to me or has a problem with a rule, is if they have a legitimate reason, I try to give it some credence and then respond in a way in which we reach a compromise that we can all sort of live with.
How about dealing with the delicate subjects that always come up during the young people's lives and parents have to contend right. with them? We're talking about sex. Right. We're talking about things they watch on TV that need to be explained to them, dealing right. with parts of our life that might be, you know, not traditional. What sort of sense do you have for dealing with that?
So I think the earlier you start having conversations about tricky, delicate, difficult subjects like sex and intimate relationships or drugs and alcohol abuse, like you start at very, very young and address it in a very basic, non-threatening, age-appropriate way, it makes those conversations, I mean, they're still uncomfortable and it's still awkward, but easier to have as your kids get older and those conversations, because you can't just have the sex talk once. You don't just have to talk about drugs and alcohol once. I mean, you have that for many, many years on repeated occasions, and you find opportunities. Like, part of the reason why I love having a newspaper in the house every morning and having the fact that we all read the paper every morning, different sections of it, is that there's so many stories in there that just can start a conversation, not necessarily about them or their lives, but about things happening around them that might one day impact their lives.
I have an email here, which I think you'll enjoy. It's from a young lady by the name of Amina. Sound familiar to you? Behind you, waving at you from the other office. You are an awesome mom and really smart. Thanks for doing all you can. Plus, it's cool to hear from your point of view.
Oh, thank you, Amina.
Well, what a bright young lady. I mean, and she really makes a point that kind of what you've been making, how important it is to be able to communicate and how to hear your point of view.
Well, that's true. I think, I think she wanted to hear her name on the radio also. Bless her.
Well, we'll say it again. It's Amina. Yeah, she's a doll. Both the kids are very, very attractive.
Thank you.
What about race and religion and things of that kind? They play a role. It's part of the dynamic of our society. Are you hearing a lot about that?
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny you should bring that up, Don, because my column this past Sunday was about the first time my daughter heard the N-word.
I saw it.
And it was about how I accompanied the fourth grade class on a trip to Hannibal to the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum, and there was a performer performing a short story of his in which she said the N-word several times, and it caught me off guard. I had never talked about this word to my children. They'd never heard it before, and so I felt like I had to address it because nobody there did. Nobody brought it up before or after. Nobody talked about it in school, and I realized that just because children know historical events that have happened, like they get to an age where they understand slavery happened, doesn't mean that they have an understanding of contemporary issues of related to race or religion. And so I remember the first time I had to talk to my child about what happened on September 11th, because, you know, she wasn't born. And because we're Muslim, I felt like this was a conversation that I needed to have with her on my terms, not her hearing from someone else on their terms. So I just feel like these are really important questions and things that we have to bring up with their kids, with our children. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a long thing. Like the conversation I had, Don, with my daughter and her friends that day on their field trip was literally like 3 minutes. But I felt like I needed to lay that foundation so that we could maybe perhaps go back to that conversation later.
Mm-hmm. What about the other parents? Any sense? I know you spoke to one or two of them having read your column.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I guess I should go back and ask. I'll tell you what, though. The reaction to that column has been really interesting and really eye-opening because several people in the community here have written me and thanked me for raising this issue, especially about that book, Huckleberry Finn, mm-hmm. which, you know, I loved, and I think children should read it in school. But you cannot read it in a vacuum. You cannot read it in elementary school, perhaps not even in middle school. And when you get to high school, you have to really be aware of and have discussions about that word and the context of what happened, you know?
Sure. It's important that the teacher handle it right. That can be make a mistake. Let's see. I want to go back to our email here. We have one from David, who's going back to an earlier subject when you talked about weddings. It says, my wife and I attended a wedding 3 years ago for some friends of ours that we call the wedding of the century. The spending was insane to the point of having a graphic designer design a custom wedding crest, which was on everything, projected onto the ceiling of the ballroom, projected onto the walls of the restroom. The list goes on and on. My wife, who is savvy with these things, took an educated guess at a quarter of a million dollars. There is a wedding industrial complex indeed.
There absolutely is. And, you know, who buys into it? So this is what I've read and sort of what I'm – the ideas that I'm forming about, like, prom in weddings is that part of the way our pop culture is with reality TV and celebrity glorification and the way that social media gives everybody a chance to be the star of their own lives and project an image, that this just feeds into this notion is that I have to create and project a polished, perfect, you know, over-the-top image. And to get attention, you have to be over-the-top because there's so many things competing for attention.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Joan calling from Baldwin. Joan, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. I want to thank you, for, Alicia, for your column and for your support that you're giving your fellow mothers and family members. I'm a bit older and raised my children in California and just wanted to share my thoughts. I was just so surprised that we're still today talking about this issue because when I went to work almost 50 years ago, I had babysitting as part of my salary when I went to my job in Los Angeles. And later, after I had my second child, I was working. At the time, I was pregnant. And then when I went back to work, they not only wanted me to come back, they gave me a raise and a promotion. And again, I had leave for my pregnancy. I had leave for my child 6 weeks after my child was born. It was amazing what good quality care I had and support. We didn't have the support that you are offering, and I wished we had it.
Oh, thank you. I think
it's wonderful that you're doing that today. But I'm just, from my perspective as an older person, very worried that we are still having to deal with not having enough support for women in the workplace and mothers particularly.
It's a huge issue, and it's an issue of social justice, and it's something I feel very strongly about because, you know, I do consider myself an advocate for families, for strong families, because I think that's what makes a strong country. And I am really disgusted by politicians who speak, you know, that talk and absolutely put zero of their actions behind it. And by corporations or by companies who, you know, these are the people who want to be able to buy your products or you want to sell your products to. But if you're creating a situation in which they can't take care of their families, all of us will suffer.
You know, there are so many important female politicians today. We have 20 in the U.S. Senate. We have any number, I don't remember it, in the House of Representatives. We have mayors locally and regionally and nationally. You think this is going to change anything?
Well, I definitely think that our country is capable of change and has been able to change and survive and thrive through all sorts of difficult social troubles. But I do think that, you know, we are seeing an imbalance of where power is in our society right now in terms of who is able to call the shots, you know, in Congress. And I think when voters and when people, just ordinary citizens, sort of get fed up and decide that they are going to take a more active role in participating in all of this, then that's when we see change happen. And we've seen this throughout our history. So I am actually very optimistic that things will change.
I hope you're right. We have time, I think, for one more email. This is from a coach in Belleville. Constantly amazed at the number of parents I see at events, games, or out to dinner who just give a gaming system or cell phone instead of engaging with their kids. Why does a 9-year-old need an iPhone? Many parents don't understand that they are their kids' favorite toys. Makes me very sad.
I know, that's absolutely true. But in defense of those parents, you know, I had to come here and do this interview, and I made sure that my child brought his DS so that things would stay calm and his attention would be focused on one thing. But I think you're right. Sometimes we go overboard, and we need to be reminded that, like you said, the time you give your kids now is time that they'll treasure forever, and you will too.
The important thing is that you brought them,
yes.
You know, instead of leaving them with somebody else.
Right.
Aisha Sultan, thank you so much for being with us. Again, congratulations on this new step in your life. Around Labor Day, your nationally syndicated column, will it be called Dirty Laundry? I guess it will be.
I think that's still being worked out.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we'll stay tuned, as we say in radio. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having
Congratulations
me.
Again. And Aisha's material can be read in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, as you all know, I'm sure. Thanks for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about Circus Flora's 2013 production, A Trip to the Moon. And the St. Louis Jewish Film Festival also. Also, Aaron Williams will talk with artist Kerry James Marshall about his exhibitions at the Contemporary Art Museum St. Louis and the St. Louis Art Museum. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with James Buford as he retires after a long career as CEO and president of the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.